you for joining us, and welcome to another edition of Answers Network. I'm your host, Alan Cardoza, and if this is your first time watching or listening to the show, know that every Monday from 11 a.m. to noon Pacific time, this show will bring on special guests that can inspire, educate, and in some cases entertain, while bringing answers and options to making our lives happier, healthier, and more successful. And I'd really appreciate it if you could all do me a big favor. Please forward one of our shows to your social media group and know that sharing my show and others like it that focus on improved health, happiness, education, and success is one powerful way we can make a positive influence in the world together. Now, our topic today is also the title of our guest's new book, Leading an Emotionally Intelligent Life, which takes you on a masterful journey through the lens of a highly skilled practitioner using emotional intelligence assessment to change people's lives. So stay with us for the next 50 minutes and see how better understanding your emotional intelligence and can enrich your life and those around you. So along with being an accomplished author, our guest, Patrick Kilcar, PhD, has been director of Georgetown University Center for Personal Development since 1999. It's a center that offers direct clinical services, workshops, and training on a variety of physical health and mental health issues, especially related to emotional intelligence, leadership, and motivation. Dr. Kilcar is a master trainer in emotional intelligence, certifying professionals to use the most valid and reliable self-assessment of emotional intelligence known. It's also to assess and evaluate the social and emotional competencies of individuals in a variety of professional venues. Patrick, if I may call you that, welcome to Answers Network.
It's wonderful to be here. Thank you so much, Alan.
I've enjoyed this week. Many years ago, I tried to study. There was a book that came out talking about, you know, EQ and, you know, how much better is EQ than IQ. And I really enjoyed reading it, but I don't know that it actually stayed with me. And one of the things that I've liked about reading your book is that because with many of the examples, I feel that sort of drives some of the points home a little better for me. So I thank you for that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, I think to start with, because there's probably people out there saying, what's emotional intelligence?
Right.
So what is your definition of emotional intelligence? And to follow that, what inspired you to become a leader in the field?
You know, there is no one patent response to what's emotional intelligence per se. But I think about it in a way that feels fairly simplistic, but really to the point. And kind of social emotional intelligence is understanding my emotions in my life, you know, Patrick's emotions, the whole array from being really angry and upset to being overly joyful and in just that perfect zone. But what do they all mean? And within it, what do I do with them? How do I understand it? What do I do with them? So that's the emotional piece, the social piece. How do I read and understand what other people are experiencing, their emotions? What are they doing with them? Because if you think about in our culture, often aggression is met with aggression, just not our culture, but cultures in general. And I think emotional intelligence invites us to be in this moment where even if someone's angry or someone's in a place where it's making us uncomfortable, it doesn't mean that we have to escalate to that place. And in fact, what happens if someone's mad at me and I'm coming from a place that's calm, they feel heard and understood at that moment, what can happen? A lot of different things can happen. And, you know, the piece about getting into this whole notion of emotional intelligence, for me, it's this whole piece of, as a clinician, you know, I sit in this privileged chair. I see people come in experiencing all kinds of different things, much of which is really heavy for people to carry. But I wonder when I watch emotionally what's happening in their world, and then how do those emotions really impact and craft the relationships in their life. And I've always thought about it that way. And then when this, the notion of the EQI came along and the competencies of emotional intelligence came along, I really gravitated towards it because it began to make sense with the way that I looked at what all of us as human beings are going through.
You know, as you were saying that, and I was thinking about both positive and negative experiences, and I like to think that in most cases I'm the I'm the calmer head in the group, and usually that is the case. And I think part of it is because I'm looking at a situation and saying, first of all, I don't know where they're coming from. I don't know what has just occurred to them. We don't know that they're, not coming from the hospital where they got some really horrible news about a loved one, So I think that part helps. But I had an interesting situation, and it's been a long time since I had something to where somebody was just belligerent and focusing it all on me. Well, and I didn't even understand why. In fact, and it was inside a store, and I found myself looking over my shoulder going, who is he talking to? Why is he yelling at this person? Right. And I kept looking over my shoulder till he finally goes, yeah, you. And I was sort of taken aback. And I tried using each tool that I feel that I have at my disposal to calm him down. I'm sorry, I don't understand, what it is that you feel that I've done or whatever, but I'm sorry if it's something that's a problem. And what I realized in this particular situation was he kept escalating.
Right.
And he kept escalating. And then it hit me as to who he was, more so than who I thought he might be. And I realized that this was just someone who was an incredible bully. And for whatever reason, he may have problems with his wife right now. And for some reason, he needed to show he was a big man,
right,
whatever it was. But he came in and he was within inches of my nose as he's yelling and stuff. And I raised my hands up so that everybody around, because now everybody's looking. Yeah. And I said, I'm really sorry. I said, but I want you to know that I am not going to start anything here. And I don't know what it is that I can do to make you understand this. And he started yelling again and he kept going. And then I leaned in just a little bit more. And I said, I'm trying to tell you, I won't start anything. And then I whispered, I said, but I will end you if you don't back up now. And it shocked him so much that he started backing up. And what I realized at this point was this particular person was a talking bully. Mm-hmm. But when it came right down to somebody that then stood up to him, he didn't know what to do.
Right.
So anyway, and again, it's in my mind, I'm thinking, God, I don't even know how to handle this situation. It's been 30 or 40 years since anybody has acted like this.
Yeah, but you dealt with it obviously really well. And, I have my own theory, according to Patrick, about bullies and about anger. But I think, I look at it in our students here at Georgetown University, where I am. I look at it in clients that I see. And the anger that exists there, it's very real. And it's very hot. And a lot of it is, if you're able to track where some of this comes from, these individuals have just not been heard. Something is going on. Something is really difficult. And for whatever reason, whatever's happening in their world, mm-hmm. that anger, which isn't anger, it's the pain kind of pushing the anger, but it's not heard. It's not dealt with in a way that they could really understand and move forward. And that's the only thing that makes sense to me. There's lots of other different ways to describe why anger is there and what's going on. But we all, your point is an important one, because all of us, your listeners, me, you, everybody on this planet, we have a particular way of dealing with anger. And it can either be getting into somebody's face and trying to figure out how to de-escalate it the way you did. But it's shocking, though. Most of us don't do that. The vast majority. We do one of two things. Either we withdraw and then we're stewing on it. It's going over and over in our brain. People can't see it. They're not really sure what's going on. But it's alive and well and being stoked. Or we withdraw like that and then we come back and we do things in that passive aggressive place. And I'll give you an example that I had a client who was just dumbfounded because he would always go to work with his wife in the morning. They would travel into DC here, but sometimes he had to be in earlier for whatever reason. So he would take the train in. And the days that he took the train in, for some reason, his wife would just forget to come pick him up at the train station when he got home. And I said, well, don't kind of seems I what's going on here, right? He goes, no, I don't see what. He goes, well, she's mad that you didn't go in with her and she's not sure how to kind of let you know that. So she lets you know it at the end of the day when you're standing there in the pouring rain waiting for a ride. And he just kind of looked at me and he goes, really? I mean, and so that passive aggressive piece is there for all of us. Yep. And it's more how to get to that place where we really do understand our anger. And I'm telling you, we all have it.
Yep.
And what does it mean? And how do we really operate with it in a way that doesn't get us into trouble, relationally or otherwise?
Well, what drew me to the story that I just said was something that you said just prior to that, which is emotional intelligence isn't just knowing oneself, but it is knowing how to then read someone
exactly.
else. As you're saying now in this situation, the guy was getting all mad because it's all about him and he's not
right.
really taking the time to read and go, what might be going on in her head to yes. cause this to happen? So
yes. No, and that's perfect. And the piece is emotional intelligence. It doesn't mean you don't get really angry. It doesn't mean you don't get upset. It doesn't mean you don't experience a lot of pain. It's being, I really like the way you said that, because it's being able to understand not only what's happening with you, but what environmentally is going on. And you being able to kind of recognize this guy at that moment and say those very few, but very important words that just, he just stood down.
Yeah.
And which was brilliant, by the way. And it's, so that was an emotionally intelligent moment in a way I've never seen. Completely. And you know that. And I think with your background and your world travel, you can't be kind of roaming around the world, you know, in a place where your anger can just kind of plop out in the middle of a situation at any moment. You've got to be really thoughtful and contained. And that was.
Well, I thank you for that. And I also want to thank our viewers and listeners that choose to send in some questions.
Great.
And we have one that has come in. This one came in prior to the show. This one reads, as a CEO of a company with multiple offices around the world, I feel we have empowered those who lead each office by encouraging them to think outside the box. Unfortunately, with some of the societal changes over the last few years, I feel many of the relationships have broken down where managers feel it's more important to follow a newfound social agenda that is creating a division in our workforce and has alienated some of our clients. How can our managing leaders use emotional intelligence to build stronger relationships and improve communication with their teams, colleagues, and clients? And it says, thanks from Jonathan in New York.
Well, great question. And this Jonathan in New York, bravo. And it's very much the way I think about Jonathan, and I think it's important, and I hope Jonathan kind of feels or understands the comparison I'm making is the best one I can think of. No, that's the way that Jack Welch, who's prior CEO of General Electric, that's how we operated. You know, it was about this guy made decisions day in and day out that would boggle our minds, or certainly somebody like me. But he took everybody's thought and opinion and idea into account. And in the world of emotional intelligence, it's being, you know, a really appropriately emotionally independent thinker. And the independent piece is that he takes it all in and then he has to make the decision. But he's not over independent in that what other people think or feel is irrelevant. And he's not under independent, where, you know, I really have to pay attention to what everybody else is saying. And if I don't, then, you know, maybe I'll get fired as CEO or something. But this is it. It's a big deal. And that emotional intelligence, I don't know, I've read, you know, Jack Welch's book. I've heard about him in many different stories. He sure seems like the kind of guy that walked through this earth as an emotionally intelligent person when he was CEO. But the piece about the EQI and emotional intelligence is that this tool, the EQI 2.0, was made for the classroom and the boardroom. It wasn't made for a clinical session the way that I've been using it or in the way that the book captures, because it's looked at. If you go back to Dan Goleman in 1995, who wrote the book Emotional Intelligence.
That's the one.
That's it. That's kind of that's the gold standard at some level. But if you go back to that and you kind of read what he's saying, that if we are emotionally intelligent people, we will be able to be better parents. We're going to be better lovers. We're going to be better partners. We're going to be better employees. We're going to be better at what we do, because these 15 competencies that we'll go into in a little bit, but these 15 competencies that everybody on this planet operates out of every day, if they are really in sync, and or if they're not, I understand it and I'm working toward it, that what we offer people at any given moment is a sense of feeling balanced. And it goes back to feeling cared for, to feeling respected. And that piece about so much anger in our world today, and there's so much distrust of one another. I think it's because people fundamentally feel this level of disrespect. Where does it come from? We can spend a lot of time on that too, right? But so going to you know, Jonathan, and if you have, you know, employees or vice presidents or people within the organization who really understand their emotional intelligence, does that make them better at what they do? 100%.
Yeah.
Dan Goleman, I think he overshot the mark a little bit in writing the book, kind of saying, well, this is for clinicians and coaches out there, this is the holy grail. Emotional intelligence, if you find it, if you live it, you become, you know, master of the universe. Well, not really. It's more, though, that being aware of it means we're not only being aware of ourselves, we're being aware of others. Exactly what Jonathan is saying about being aware, seeing the movement in a multinational company, and seeing the movement when people really are connected and working together and respectful, and when they're not.
Yeah.
And so if you go back to the origination of the EQI 2.0, that was to do team building and, you know, where are you in your emotional intelligence? You know, how assertive are you? You know, how good do you feel in your own skin? How optimistic are you? And all of this kind of moves us toward being better at what we do, no matter what it is. And so what I just by circumstance was able to use it a number of years ago clinically, and all of a sudden began to see something which was really just remarkable. And to your point, it's in the book, it's in these stories, and realizing, well, wait a minute, this is a great tool. And it's used, you know, I use it here at Georgetown quite a bit. I use it quite a bit, you know, across the board and as a trainer. But wow, what it can offer people in terms of looking at these 15 pieces of what's going on in their life is amazing. And, you know, imagine if there was a mobile hanging from the ceiling, and on that mobile, there were 15 different pieces of anything. Well, if I realize that I'm really not being assertive and it's making a big impact negatively in my life, well, if I begin to really work on that assertiveness and I touch the mobile assertive, whoop, everything moves. It affects all of the other different parts because they're not mutually exclusive. They do. Kind of like a spider web, that they're connected, some more distally and some more proximally, but they're connected to one another.
I really like that analogy, because as you were doing, I was visualizing it myself. And when you talked about touching it, and I was thinking, well, one of the things that happens when you touch it, yeah, all the other ones, you know, if you push it this way, all the other ones go the opposite way, you know, and stuff. So I like that.
Yeah, thank you.
You know, you were talking,
Well, I hope I at least kind of did a little bit of foray into answering Jonathan's question. It's really big and it requires a lot. And it's a lot more than a CEO can ever kind of step into and deal with. It's more, though, creating those opportunities for offsites, right? Creating those opportunities for meetings, but staff meetings where we're able to talk about stuff that is meaningful. And talking about kind of where we are in the world, for instance, that story you told at the beginning, when I'm in staff meetings and I'm doing all kinds of different things, I'm now just realizing this, I don't really connect with those that I work with at a personal level. It's all about work, and work is kind of consuming. But what you shared was a really critical story that allows me to understand you in the crease of that story better. And, you know, being able to share who we are with one another, that's also delimited because we're also just damn busy. And there's always so much stuff that we got to be sweeping here or sweeping there that we're not really paying attention to what we're sweeping. So, yeah.
You know, when you mentioned Welsh, it reminded me of, you know, there are a lot of people, and I think he's a good example, but, you know, so taking into consideration large companies that are household names provides some examples of successful leaders who have demonstrated high levels of emotional intelligence to help them get there and how it may have positively impacted their leadership and decision-making skills.
It's a great question, and I'll give you two different examples. They almost sound the same, but they're different. One is, I had a client come in and say his boss came in. This guy was in sales and pre-pandemic, and sales were not hitting the mark. And the guy came in who was a vice president, so somewhere near CEO, but not quite, not in the C-suite, I don't think. Mm-hmm. Comes in and starts yelling at, I mean, literally walks in, starts yelling at everybody, "What the hell are you doing? Why aren't we hitting our numbers? I'm getting slammed from above because of what you're doing." And it went on and on like this. And he was really taken aback. He wasn't sure what to do. It wounded him. I mean, it kind of threw him off. And that kind of moment brings out the absolute worst in terms of what's possible. So does that kind of get somebody wanting to step up and do their absolute best because they're doing what they believe in? No matter what it is. I mean, if we're doing it professionally, it aligns with something that's important to us with our own skills. But this guy's then moving out of a place of fear, selling whatever, doing whatever, because he's afraid if he doesn't, he'll lose his job, versus doing really well. And it's coming from a place of acknowledgement and respect. So there's that. And then another one where a very similar kind of circumstance, a woman came in and very similar. They just weren't meeting their numbers for a variety of different reasons. And this guy came in, sat down. He was in the C-suite. I think he wasn't CEO, but I think he was COO or something. I think it was a COO because they were coming in talking about finances. And he came in and he sat down and he goes, "Okay, we're not hitting our numbers. What's going on? Let's break it down. Let's figure out how we can step back out and make a difference." And this person said, this may just be larger than you. And there's not a lot we can do other than do our best. So this is the track. Well, she was telling me this story, and this was after, you know, a while after this other guy had told the story. And I just thought to myself, my gosh, you know, this is it. This is how you treat people. This is how you get people to do better. And so that's kind of at the corporate level. It's being able to hear where people are. What are they doing? That they're able to give you know, their ideas, they're able to tell their story and people hear it, especially people that are in a more elevated position within the company, that whatever is going on, kind of like that Jack Welch story earlier, that what they think and what they feel and what they're experiencing matters. And you don't have to take the EQI 2.0 or some other kind of assessment to be able to figure this out. It's more, goes back to Jonathan. Jonathan feels to me like the kind of guy that would call a meeting and sit down in that meeting and say, okay, this is where we're doing really well. And this is where we feel like we're not doing as well as what's going on. He's going to walk people through it, get people involved, and not only the problem, which, you know, you go back to that first example with this guy coming in and screaming and yelling, that's completely focused on the problem. There is no solution in mm-hmm. that. But it's looking at the problem and then inviting everybody to come up with a solution. And that is being an emotionally intelligent person. It's also being somebody that is just aware of the people around them and just sharing respect. If you take that even down to a parental level, you know, and many of us out here are parents, that I had a parent come in one time and she was really having a tough time with her daughter. And the daughter wasn't listening. She was, you know, she was just entering into adolescence. And we talked about what the daughter could do, what she could do. They go away. They come back for the next visit. And the daughter's all folded up, scrunched up face, not saying a thing. And I said, geez, what's going on? I mean, it just feels like there's really some kind of bad energy. And I thought you both left with an idea of what could be different. And the daughter looked at the mother and said, okay, I'm going to tell you. I went out of my way to anticipate what would be helpful for her, what would be nice, what would maybe even take some of the burden off of her. And my mother, after all that, looked at me and said, it's about damn time. If we want to kill something in a human being, I know. And I really think my heart stopped for a moment when I heard it. I went, oh my God. But that's that piece of, look, this is a stressed out mother and I get it. And we all get it. It's that piece though of this emotionally intelligent part of us. If we can really get behind understanding our own needs and the needs of others, the possibilities are endless. At that moment, it's just a relationship killer. And so it travels up and down, kind of vertically and horizontally.
All right. We're speaking with Dr. Patrick Kilcar. The book is called Leading an Emotionally Intelligent Life. And we're going to take a break. But when we come back, Patrick, I'd love for you to touch on those 15 points that you mentioned that is going to help everybody listening to lead an emotionally intelligent life. We'll be right back. You're listening to or watching Answers Network.
Conflict International are experts at uncovering the truth. Our specialist team has decades of experience in providing a range of bespoke investigation and intelligence services to companies and individuals. Whether you need professional screening or background checks of employees, due diligence of potential clients or business partners, asset tracing services, or surveillance, Conflict International has a rapid response team on hand to get you to the heart of the matter. Our key strength is in our global capabilities. We can tap into an extensive network of trusted professional investigators based in most jurisdictions worldwide, enabling us to go almost anywhere a case takes us. Conflict International has decades of experience with a diverse range of skills among our team developed from backgrounds in military and security intelligence services, as well as practice lawyers. Visit our website today at conflictinternational.com to find out more about our services. That's conflictinternational.com. Global reach, local knowledge.
And we're back. You are with Answers Network. We're talking with Dr. Patrick Kilcar. And when we went to break, I asked if we could talk a little bit about there's 15 key points that he has in the book. And I don't anticipate we're going to have time to do all 15. But if you could pull out a few of the key ones that you think people will get the most benefit from.
Let me kind of talk about some of these competencies from the standpoint of a story. So in the book is a lot of stories about people that come in, their background, what they're struggling with, where they are, and then what happens with their understanding of self after they're introduced to these 15 competencies. But I'll give you an idea. A young woman came in to see me, and very attractive, very smart. You could tell the kind of person that people would want to be friends with. She just had that really nice aura and energy. And she said to me, look, my life is really good. I don't fully understand, you know, even why I'm here. However, something feels off. And we talked about it. And generally, after somebody comes for the fourth session, I give them the EQI. I do that because if somebody comes four times, the probability is they're going to continue to come. And then I'll be able to kind of refer to what's going on with the competencies, you know, over the course of our relationship. And she took the EQI, and when it came back, she came into the office, and sometimes I send it to people in advance. Sometimes I wait for them to come in. But she came in and I handed it to her. And page 3 of the EQI comprehensive report is, it details the 15 competencies. And what's going on? It starts with self-regard. You know, how do I feel about Patrick? It ends with optimism. You know, how do I feel about Patrick in the world achieving what he wants, provided he goes after it? And then a number of in between. Well, she came in, and one of the competencies was emotional self-awareness. And her emotional self-awareness was very high. I mean, she's really aware of what she's feeling, what's going on, what's happening in the world, and in many ways, what's happening with other people. Then below that is emotional self-expression. And the emotional self-expression was low. So just let's just look at this for 1 second as we travel down these competencies. She's very aware of what she's experiencing and feeling in the world, yet doesn't talk about it. She won't really bring it up. Her independence was low. Now, if you remember a moment ago, I was talking about it. Independence is, how much do I rely on what other people are doing in terms of what I do? Or how much do I only rely on myself versus what other people are doing? And what it suggested, the low independence, suggested that she went along with whatever people are doing, for the most part. And then it went down to flexibility, which is, and these are all obviously the competencies. And her flexibility was very high. And what that, if you're low flexibility, what that means is you're kind of, you're not going to be really making many changes. And if you do, it's going to be begrudgingly, kind of like Calvin of Calvin and Hobbes. You're just not going to want to be kind of entering into any change or anything that shifts what you know. Hers was very high, meaning that she was up for anything, whatever anybody did, regardless of what she wanted, she did. And then with that, her stress tolerance was extremely high. Now, if we're low in something, let's say I'm low in assertiveness, we know what that is. Right. It means, you know, I'm not stepping up. I'm not saying the things that I need to in the way that I need to. But we can also be too high in something. So let's use assertiveness. If I'm too high in assertiveness, now this is in comparison to the 15, the self-competencies in relation to one another. Okay. Mm-hmm. But if my assertiveness is higher than most of the others, it could mean that I'm overutilizing that particular competency, meaning that it's too strong. So assertiveness at that level, if it's way out there ahead of the others, could then really be aggression. It's not being assertive anymore. It's being a bully, to go back to this guy that was getting in your face. It's that kind of thing. And the high stress tolerance means she could carry an enormous amount. So we sat there together, kind of going through it, just like I'm talking with you.
Right.
And she began to cry. The only time she cried since I met her. And I let some time go by and I said, can you talk about what's happening? And she said, I love my friend. but I am also a human doormat. Nobody asks me how I'm doing. Nobody really checks up on me. Nobody asks if they can plan the vacation or not. And I never really understood what was going on, but I knew something was going on that was slowly debilitating me. And so once she was armed with this and she could kind of see what was happening, she began to really make some pretty fundamental changes. One of the changes that I thought was really pretty remarkable is there was a big, a big vacation they were all going to be doing, she and her friends. Typically, she's the one that would find the venue. She would do it all. And she sent a note to everybody and said, hey, listen, I'm really jammed right now. And, you know, I'd like somebody else to kind of step up and do this. I can't. And she was really worried. In fact, she didn't sleep the night that she sent it out because she was worried people were going to, you know, literally jettison her from their life. And what they sent was really pretty amazing. And it was, go, girl. Hey, it's about time we pick up the pace. I mean, these kind of things, which was really remarkable. And that was this shift. And it seems like it would be a subtle shift. For her, though, it wasn't. I mean, it was her being able to begin to truly tack in to the kind of win that she wanted socially and emotionally. I mean, does that make sense?
It makes perfect sense. And it sounds like there was an insecurity there that just posing that question and getting that response had a huge impact on her feeling more self-assured and more secure about her position with her friends.
Yeah, well said. I mean, that's absolutely perfect. And then, I mean, some of the kind of different people that I've met or the kind of things that I talk about in the book are on my brain. But there's one in particular, was a young guy that came to see me who grew up in a family. And again, when you read some of these stories in the book, it's very hard for me to believe even some of these things could actually happen or that children could be treated the way that they were by certain parents. But I assure you, it's all real. And this young guy came to see me, tall, handsome guy, and he said, my life is really out of control. And so he began to tell me about his life. He grew up in a family with very religious parents. And the parents often kind of instilled within the family or instituted within the family poverty. And of all the other children, this young guy was homeschooled through high school. And at the end of high school, what would be high school, he was four grades behind. So he really wasn't homeschooled. He wasn't given any intellectual direction. And the messages he got from his family were just heartbreaking. You know, you're not smart. Not everybody can be smart. It's okay. Just let it go. And yet here's a guy that worked incredibly hard, got his GED, then got into school and graduated college with a STEM degree in chemistry, actually, and then got two graduate degrees, all the while believing that at any moment his life was going to go up in smoke, that he was this imposter, that he was going to be found out. Now, he also did have some issues on the spectrum, where being able to fully understand what people are doing or saying was a little bit tough for him. Being able to gauge a response was a bit tough for him. But and when he took the EQI, when it came back, it's the lowest in certain areas that I've ever seen to this day. I mean, in the 20s and 30s. Now, wow. It goes up to 125. 100, you're in the sweet spot. That means you're doing really well. Things are great. And he saw it and he goes, I'll never get out from under all of this, will I? And I said, not only will you, but you're going to be able to kind of step in and live exactly the kind of life that you want. Now, in the book, there's a before and after. A year later, he took it again, the EQI. And it's stunning. But it's this piece that, in terms of emotional awareness, emotional intelligence, that he was an assertive guy. I mean, he would say what was on his mind, but he often felt that when he said something, he wasn't sure if people actually heard him. He was made fun of a lot at work. And when he would date, he would, after a date, women would really love going out with him. And then what they would do would kick him to the curb in ways that he just didn't understand. And this happened once, and he came in and he said, you know, this woman said she loved the date. It was great. And then, you know, I'm bothering her. I'm getting in her space and face. And I looked at all the text messages between them, and there was nothing inappropriate from him at all. And he finally began to kind of recognize that he, for whatever reason, something happens in these relationships where people begin to take advantage of him. And it required a lot on his part. But as he did it, his stress tolerance began to expand. You know, his optimism, which was the lowest of everything, really began to expand. Social responsibility began to expand. And empathy. He really had no empathy, according to the EQI. He did. He just was not at all sure how to use it or what it meant. So the competencies really guide us into understanding what about us is really strong. What do we really want to work on to strengthen it even more? And what might be used, you know, in a way that's overcompensating. And I think about this guy often because of what he was able to do, what he chose to do, and to really begin to live a life that honored his ability and honored who he was as a person.
Now, with this particular person and with many other people, what percentage of this would you say was perception and what percentage would you say was reality?
Yeah, what a great question. But so here's the piece. I love that question because nobody ever asks anything like that. But perception drives our reality, right? So if I believe that Patrick is not worthy, if I truly believe it, then whatever I step into, it's going to be represented in my reality. And it goes back to that notion of, you know, going out on these dates with women that start off really apparently liking him and loving it, and then just, you know, kicking him to the curb. And because there's this piece that within him, and we began calling it the time bomb, there's this time bomb in his brain that inevitably was going to go off and take everything away. And so it was reshaping that perspective, which you're absolutely right on, which then allowed him to really reshape, you know, his lived experience, that reality. Brilliant.
Yeah. And as you were saying, it reminded me, and there's I don't remember who the famous person is, but there's a famous story out there of a household name of brilliance that when he was a child, his teacher sent home a letter to his mother and said, you know, give this to your mother. And she read it and she cried a little bit. And he said, well, what's wrong? And she said, well, the teacher said that you're too smart for all of these kids in this particular school, and I need to put you in another school that will work better for you. And he went, great. And he went on to become a very, very famous, highly intelligent person. And when his mother died, he found that letter. And what the letter said was
the opposite,
just the opposite, that he was too dumb to stay in their school.
Unbelievable.
But yet, you know, it's, again, the perception of it. Once this young man believed he was so smart, he was.
So. And, you know, you're also bringing up a piece that I think about all the time, and it does come through with the competencies, but it's just that the degree of personal resilience that's out there just never ceases to amaze me. And I'd like to believe that maybe as a therapist, I can do some good, or maybe it is somewhat helpful, but I don't do it for that. I mean, I do it because all of what we're talking about, the competencies and people's strength and their resilience, just makes me a better man. And yep. It's amazing.
We have another question that's coming in, and we only have about 4 minutes, but sure. I think if you maybe might want to answer this one, taking into consideration the term you just used with resilience.
Yes.
This one reads, we seem to live in a time in which negativity, fear, and anxiety have are thrust upon us daily, be it social media, network news, or political demonizing. I'm seeing changes in my two teenage children that worries my husband and I. How can emotional intelligence help individuals navigate difficult emotions such as fear and anxiety, and how can we mitigate these influences on our children? This is from Catherine in Seattle, Washington.
Catherine, I think about this all the time, and with our kids. You know, the notion that the social world our kids are in today, especially teenagers, it feels like they're walking through a minefield. And, you know, what information are they taking in? What aren't they? The difference, though, between other people's children and your children is that your children have you. To be able to talk about it, what are they experiencing? What's happening with it? And I cannot overstate being able to sit with them and hear their fears. And the problem is, parents, if we hear our kids' fears, we feel some obligation that we have to fix it. A lot of it we can't fix. But what we can do is create a space that they can talk about really what they're feeling and experiencing, and that we can talk about what we as parents are. And together, what can we do to maybe push against that some? And, you know, what I hear a lot from parents about their 9-year-olds wanting cell phones and smartphones and, you know, and PlayStation, and it goes on and on and on and on. And as parents, we don't like our kids hurting, and we don't like our kids upset. So no is a difficult thing to say. However, in understanding our children the way every parent does, hopefully, no is okay sometimes. And it's okay in terms of slowing their exposure to a world where when I was 9 or 10 or 11 or a teenager, I read the paper about what happened yesterday. What happens today is our children see it in real time. It's happening right now. And the emotional piece connected to that, I don't think we've begun to even understand. And so, Catherine, you are really the linchpin here that can make all the difference, you and the other adults around you, to be able to talk with them, because that sensitivity is there. I hear it. I feel it. And my sense is they already do. But that's the route that I think that we as parents can go.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Patrick, I got to tell you, first of all, I have thoroughly enjoyed this. And time has flown by.
It really did.
Is there anything else? Is there anything coming up, anything that we can share other than the fact that the book, again, I highly recommend it. The book can be purchased pretty much anywhere, I believe.
Right. Amazon usually would be great. No, you know what, again, we, as therapists, we're always searching for the Holy Grail. Is the EQI or the 15, kind of those ways of looking at the competencies in our life, is that the Holy Grail? No. It is a way, though, of allowing us to understand not only ourselves, but other people better. And I really enjoyed writing it. And sometimes people ask me about aspects of the book, and I go, you know, I think I got to go back and reread it because I can't really remember that piece, which is so great because it allows me to step back into it and reabsorb it. And yeah, I've thoroughly enjoyed this as well, Alan. Thank you so much.
And actually, I just had two thoughts. One in regards to Jonathan with the multinational company and offices everywhere.
Yes.
Send a copy of the book to each one of the leaders and ask them to in one page send back to you what they got from it. And that, I think, will tell you a lot about those particular leaders, which ones are going to be able to stay with you and go far, and which ones maybe are not getting it.
Well, and even to add to that really quick is to read it. And kind of like, you know, couples do, I suppose, read it and talk about it as a group. And, you know, not only this book, but all the other ones that are out there, well, what are we hearing? And not, and you're right. I think that that format you're talking about will make all the difference in the world.
Yep. And by the way, that can work with sitting down with our teenagers as well. I know, I know with mine, I chose certain books and I provided incentive to read certain books so that they would respond back to me and I would know that, yes, that they got something from it. So again, in this case, for the woman worried about her teenagers, yes, you know, it it reads real well that they can pull from it as well.
You bet. Incentives are good. Bravo. Yeah. So,
yes. All right. Again, thank you so much, Patrick. And I would love to get together and talk more. If you have something else come up, let us know. I would love to have you back. Yeah. Or I think even if we can get together off air, it would be wonderful.
I would love it. This is absolute treat. Thank you so much.
All right. You're welcome. And for everybody out there, be with us next week when we are joined by Donna Marie Hayes as she discusses her new book, These Broken Roads, Scammed and Vindicated, One Woman's Story. I don't know about anybody else out there, but in this day and age, our phones are either through text or through calls. There is more scams going on out there, and it's very, very difficult to navigate those waters. If you read this book, I think you will not only be able to navigate the waters well, but you also feel good about how somebody figured out how to become vindicated. And please visit our archives of past interviews at answers.network, or you can subscribe to the show through Apple Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Spotify, SoundCloud, YouTube, Rumble, Spreaker, and so many other popular podcasts. Podcast platforms. If you like what you hear, please leave a review. It will let us reach more people, and I want you to know we greatly appreciate it. Next time you're on Instagram, Facebook, or X, formerly Twitter, please remember, stop by our page, check out some of our latest posts. If you like them, please like us and spread the word. For everybody out there, be good human beings and be with us again next week on Answers Network.
You're listening to Answers Network with Alan Cardoza, only on LA Talk Radio.